Thank you, Rick, for that wonderful presentation. I think you said some things that are already making me rethink some of the things I was about to say, so that's great. I just want to say also thank you for this opportunity. I think it's always a pleasure as an artist to be able to discuss the ideas and the process of making something and to think about the research in a dialogical way. It's not always a given in an art context, and so I really appreciate this opportunity. The project that I am presenting is a film called Kere Matu Kere, or The Lake and the Lake. And it's an attempt to rework some persistent images of lakes, photographic images as well as imagined ideals that have become politically significant in the context of an environmental crisis. And this film dwells in the peripheries of a highly polluted lake in Bangalore or Bengaluru, a city that also gets called the Silicon Valley of India, the Garden City, the City of Lakes. And the film I'm making is, the lake that I'm filming around is called Belandur and is flanked by special economic zones and some of Bangalore's wealthiest tech parks and their high-rise residential enclaves. So just to give you a sense of where this film is taking place a little bit, in the presentation I'll be showing you excerpts of the film and then also making some notes and comments about the process of making. Alex and Alisa invited Rick and I to choose a kind of segment from the Beyond Story Manifesto to respond to in this presentation. And last December, when I was kind of deep in the process of editing this film, was the first time that I read the manifesto, and this segment really kind of stood out to me and actually was very encouraging in helping me finish the edit because I wasn't working with a story, and oftentimes I was kind of like, oh man, maybe I should just have a story to guide this film. So it's really great to be able to connect it back to this. I'm gonna jump in and show you an excerpt from the film. Okay, I'm gonna pause it there. Could I have the lights back, maybe? Thank you. Thanks. That's gonna keep happening through this presentation. That's okay, thank you. Something to say about what we just saw. Bangalore's keres were constructed to provide water security to the region. And we call these keres lakes, even though a more accurate translation would be tanks. And they're engineered structures that have always been reservoirs holding things like rainwater, aquatic life, prayer offerings, sacrifices. And of late, surrounded by this fast developing city, they also hold more and more waste. So a recent estimate says that over 300 million liters of untreated sewage flows into Belandur every day. In one sense, we can recognize that the lake is actually providing an important service to a city that's lacking crucial infrastructure by holding its untreated sewage. But this service went largely unacknowledged for a long time. In fact, when farmers and fishing communities protested the pollution in the water in the 80s, they were beaten by the police, and it took them a long time to put in just minimal protections against the letting of industrial sewage into this lake. But when the foam showed up, it ruptured this fiction of a natural space that was somehow free of the contradictions of hyperdevelopment. And when it started to fly into the balconies of the luxury condos around the lake, then we really started to hear, we started to hear a lot about the issue of pollution and toxicity. The stories that got churned up with the foam were largely stories of crisis, of no future, nostalgic stories about a pristine past where such kinds of surreal side effects of hyperdevelopment were not visible, and stories about eco-heroes and government villains. But despite all the commotion, even after a decade, the foam still remains and continues to froth and burn and suffocate and forge all kinds of new contact zones. So I found myself asking, what do these narratives of crisis obscure? What's being left out of the picture for this crisis to make sense, and for it to make sense now?
Okay, let me set this. Yeah, okay.
So we're looking at an album of sunsets that one of the residents around the lake from a Lakeview apartment is showing me, and this is kind of amazing to see. There's over 100 photographs in the album, but in every single one of them, they crop out the settlement that's also a huge part of their view.
Pretty, right?
That's better. Yep.
Everything.
This. Your phone has a really good zoom, I would say.
I'm muting the film so I can kind of talk a little bit over it. So these are the same images that then end up over WhatsApp, through social media, Facebook, and then get used to mobilize really a range of activism, from cleaning drives to campaigns to get people to separate their household waste, to kind of eviction demands on evicting the slums. All of those kinds of actions use the same images. And so it's not a coincidence that what's being cropped out of these images is also what is labeled as unclean. And several residents from the high-rises that surround the lake kind of regard those who live in the informal settlements on the banks as being part of the pollution problem. So ironically, those who do the work of collecting, recycling, and actually managing the waste are also somehow marked for banishment along with that waste itself. Sorry, I'm having trouble reading this, but so in that way, the lake becomes a site for environmentalism and environmentalism often becomes a euphemism for class-based, religious, and nationalistic politics. So people now want to, thank you, people now want to fence, surveil, and restrict access to the lake as in an attempt to save it. But while this might deter people from dumping garbage around the lake, it doesn't really address the systemic reasons why the waste keeps showing up there in the first place, nor does it recognize all the ways in which people have continued to access the lake for living and livelihood. I see this partitioning of waste and toxicity from healthy life and this fixation on eliminating the superficial signs of pollution as kind of mirroring the kinds of images that of the lakes that we see circulating today. On the one hand, it's kind of these pristine images of a beautiful lake as an aesthetic object, and on the other hand, it's the abject images of the alien foam that's kind of engulfing the city. We rarely see people in any of these images, and we rarely see both of those qualities or both of those realities together. And to me, all of that points to to me, that kind of points to a deep alienation from the integral presence of waste in any society, and this kind of obscuring of the daily reality of living, and some would say dying, with toxicity. So the film kind of reworks this partitioning and the static image of a lake that is in need of rescue, just because it refuses to appear clean, by showing all the ways in which the lake comes into being through its use and misuse, and through practices of commoning. So depending on with whom we're standing, the lake becomes work, it becomes waste, or it's just a view. And the film is kind of organized around a series of attempts to see these spaces of toxicity as simultaneously being spaces of life and work. That is what I'm calling a toxic commons. Usually we think about commons as shared assets, but in this case we also have to think about them as a shared problem. And despite the poisonous nature of these spaces to the living beings that inhabit them, and despite the high risk that they pose in terms of in an economic sense, they still remain an important and valuable resource and a refuge for a number of counterpublics. So the film, really all it does is provides a way to, a durational and a vibrational way to experience some of those entanglements, and to show that really it is impossible to separate ourselves and our waste from that what we have been taught to see as nature. So a lot of the film is shot in an observational mode through other cameras and screens and looking devices, but the act of observation, or kind of smooth observation, is constantly being interrupted in the film by flying foam, by noxious gases that send me off into daydreams, and by these moments of looking and looking back, being looked back at, and from questions and comments from passersby. I keep calling it a lake film because I think that the lake has made the film too in some ways. It's not just the subject of it. The environment is constantly interrupting these processes of observation and bringing to our awareness the ways in which these images are fragments of reality, and are always produced through states of embodiment and entanglement. Because there's a lot of methane coming from the water, it's very noxious around the lake, and I would often have these kind of lightheaded moments where I was kind of like, "Whoa, what am I filming again?" And so the film is really kind of structured in a spatial way. It's we move from different positions around the lake, more or less within this ecological buffer zone where no more development is permitted. It's kind of like 100 meters. It's a radius that keeps changing as new laws get passed, but the film is pretty much filmed from inside of it, except for these daydreams that then go out. And while it was important to give people a sense of how this place becomes valuable to different groups of people, I also had the concern of maintaining the anonymity of people who are regularly criminalized as trespassers, polluters, and illegals. So I was not interested in kind of documenting people who might have a need to remain imperceptible. The film doesn't have any protagonists. I was reading Amitav Ghosh's book called The Great Derangement, where he kind of makes a claim that in times of drastic environmental change, we need to think beyond the pervasive structure of the modernist novel, which, according to him, in a modernist structure, in the novel structure, the environment acts as a mere backdrop for individual moral adventures. And so the film attempts to implode those ideas of backdrop, background, and figure, and instead, kind of, rather than casting stories of individuals or communities who live around the lake, I kind of just allow the film to dwell in these peripheries, allowing myself to breathe, be enveloped and estranged by this place. And what I'm left with is a document that kind of questions those crucial categories based on which this crisis, the narratives of crisis, are formed, like nature, culture, clean, valuable, functional, and toxic. I'll do one last segment and just kind of conclude to say that in this current moment, you know, we're often told that stories are the forms through which we can dig into the narratives of the past, which are available for us to actually play with safely while our future kind of teeters with uncertainty. And well, Rick, your presentation made me think very differently, but I wrote this before your presentation, and I kind of thought that stories for me had a sense of pastness to them. Even when they talk about the future, there's a kind of pastness when they're told. And I just want to wrap up by saying quoting Jill Cassid, who says that to confront Anthropocene crisis is not to cast a prospect of a distancing projection onto a deep past or a lost future, but rather to work from within the scene which we are enmeshed. So thank you.